We're exploring the place that the humanities have in medicine. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. UW-Eau Claire received a grant from the NEH, the National Endowment for the Humanities, to develop an integrative health humanities certificate program. And the program is bringing together six departments at the university to deliver this 12-credit program. What do you think the humanities offer the medical field? English and history, philosophy, what do these disciplines teach us about healthcare and how we approach in public health the COVID-19 pandemic? Are the humanities important in your work in the healthcare field? Tell us why, 800-642-1234. Louisa Rice is department chair and history professor at UW-Eau Claire. She's co-project director of the certificate program. Louisa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about what you're designing here.
Okay, so we applied for the grant last fall, in fact, before anyone had heard of COVID. So last September, and we learned that we received it in April. So we're just starting to design the program. And the idea is to bring together, as you said, multiple disciplines across the university, centering the humanities, but also working with the sciences in particular, to try to think through how the humanities can help inform healthcare practices, both for our pre-healthcare students and for humanities students who are just interested in thinking through how the humanities that they're already learning about can influence the way they think about their own healthcare and the health of their loved ones.
Well, it's interesting about this bridge because when you hear the term medical arts, for instance, you realize that medicine and humanities have a lot in common. Can you tell us about how these two go together?
So for us, one of the most important things is the sort of way the humanities thinks through problems, so that it teaches students about empathy, about critical thinking, about seeing patients as whole people, not just as a medical issue. So, for example, we're going to include a course on the ethics of healthcare taught by somebody in our philosophy department. And that course teaches about how we approach issues of life and death, things like the end-of-life care and how you make decisions about end-of-life care, because that's more than a medical decision, right? That's really about your own understanding of morality and your own sense of ethics. So a class like this can really help students think through their own ideas about those issues and how they might impact their future medical practice, but also their own decisions as patients.
So what I'm hearing is that this is not, you know, medicine is not just about studying the illnesses and the diseases, but it's also understanding the impact they have on the person who's diagnosed and their families, their communities, and even all of society. It's these bigger stories.
Right. That's great. That's a really good way of putting it. I think, you know, we're seeing that with COVID. Coincidentally, this is happening at the same time as we're designing this new program, right? Basically, the way that particular disease is impacting people is about medical science, but it's also about the histories of communities in the United States, right? Like how African Americans or the Latinx or the Hmong community here in Eau Claire, how they've had access to healthcare over a century, how they continue to have unequal access, and how their sort of experience in the community is a historical one that needs to be understood that way, as well as understood through medical reasoning.
And once you understand that, you might have more insights on the medicine part, the science part.
That's right. Yeah. You know, there's also, we're hoping to bring in this idea of narrative medicine, which is a whole field in itself, which really comes out of English and helps to think about how people present themselves in a medical situation, how they write through their experience of healthcare and disease. And that really requires the critical thinking skills of a discipline like English to actually be able to analyze texts and think again about the whole person with more empathy.
We're talking with Louisa Rice. She's department chair and professor of history at UW-Eau Claire. We're learning about a new certificate program that is in the works that combines health and the humanities and disciplines across the university. You can join in. What do you think about health humanities? Do you work in this area? What do healthcare professionals need to learn about the humanities as they enter the field? You can join in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Louisa, as you work to develop this program, and here we are in a pandemic, how do you see that your work in collaborating across the university in philosophy, in English, in humanity, or in, you know, history and social work, how do you come together to figure out what this program looks like?
Well, there's like a practical answer to that, too. There's a lot of Zoom meetings right now. we're sharing. It's been really interesting as a collaborative project because we all approach this very differently from our own disciplines. And I've been involved at the university before in these sort of collaborative, multidisciplinary programs. And I think that's the way a lot of us as scholars get our best ideas, is just hearing about similar problems from different perspectives. So we're reading the same things right now. We have a bunch of articles that we're reading together, and then they come from these different disciplines, and we're all talking about the way they speak to our own research. So we're using that to design what will be a core course. So there'll be an introduction to the health humanities, which will be team taught, we hope. So not only will it be interdisciplinary, but we'll also have experts in the classroom who are from these different disciplines, because very often interdisciplinary courses are sort of tokenly interdisciplinary. But this way, we hope we really will have different levels and experiences and expertise in the same room. So that's our first goal. And then the second is thinking about how we're actually going to collaborate with community partners, because part of the grant is that there's a component of experiential learning. So students actually need to get out in the community and work in these sort of health humanities settings. So part of what we're planning to do, and part of the team that's meeting, is building these community partnerships. So we can imagine internships and maybe undergraduate research projects that involve working with community partners who themselves can see some benefit from the health humanities.
What would be an example of a health humanities setting, work setting?
Well, we have a couple right now. The university, since 2017, has entered into a research collaboration with the Mayo Clinic Health System. And so far, that has predominantly been matching academics in the sciences with clinicians, but we've also started to see some interest in Mayo working with humanities scholars too. So for example, that might be oral histories, right? Going in and talking with clinicians about their experience in the community. We have many people who work at Mayo who are not originally from Eau Claire or even maybe from the United States. So understanding how they came to the health field and how someone like a historian, a student who's trained in oral history through our public history program, could actually tease out those connections between life experiences of a doctor or a nurse.
And we have to pause there. Yeah, we have to pause there with UW-Eau Claire history professor Louisa Rice as we learn about a new humanities program. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The humanities and healthcare disciplines may not typically be thought of as going hand in hand, But an emerging field merges both health and humanities to solve problems in healthcare. UW-Eau Claire is launching an integrative health humanities certificate program. We're learning about it. How does history and culture bring humanism into medicine? Can health humanities tackle structural inequalities that are before us? What can grants and foundations do to encourage the use and study of the humanities in our healthcare system? Why does it matter? Join in 800-642-1234. We have UW-Eau Claire History Professor Louisa Rice, who stays with us. Louisa, you're talking there about the Mayo Clinic, and it has this Center for Humanities in Medicine. I was reading about how it's integrating the arts and other expressions of human culture into healing. How does that work?
So, in I think a lot of different ways. We're thinking about that as a humanities as a form of therapy in a couple of different ways. One is through clinicians themselves who might be looking for some relief from burnout, right? So in sort of creative writing programs that may help them express themselves in different ways and sort of work through some workplace issues. The other is trying to think about that with patients. So one of our other community partners, we're hoping to be the Chippewa Valley Museum here in Eau Claire. They run a memory cafe for people who are suffering from dementia. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. We've talked about memory cafes here on our program before. Yeah. Carry on.
That's great. So one idea we had is that, for example, historical objects could be brought into the memory cafe as a way of sort of triggering memories and ways of talking for people who have dementia. So that would, again, involve history students in that setting. It would involve English students in a sort of creative writing way, too. So I think there's different ways of thinking about the intersection of humanities and healthcare that's both for patients and also for practicing clinicians as well.
Let's bring in a call. Rita is joining us from Green Bay this morning. Hi, Rita.
Good morning. How are y'all this morning?
Doing well.
Fine day in Wisconsin. Yes, I did have a question. If there was the aspect of theology, spirituality, or religion brought into the equation, because when you deal with humanities, I've dealt with end of life in cancer situations or suicide and depression, and it's something that always comes into people wondering, where am I going, or what's going to happen after life, or even just having a sense of peace in your spirit during a hard time. My husband suffered from cancer, and so we had to reach out in other areas other than medical field on getting peace in our heart and mind. So I was just wondering if they were bringing in anything like that. And I will go to my radio for the answer.
Rita, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Our philosophy department is actually our philosophy and religion department at Eau Claire. So the two very much go hand in hand for us. Yes, and I think the healthcare ethics course and possibly other courses, right? We're still thinking about designing new courses to bring in exactly the kinds of issues that Rita was there talking about. Right? How do you approach palliative care? How do you talk to people through their worst moments? I think that really does bring in religious issues, spirituality, and of course, thinking about this through also different ethnic groups and different racial approaches means that we have to think about how other cultures also think through spirituality and religious issues.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Louisa Rice. She's department chair and history professor at UW-Eau Claire. We're learning about a new certificate program that combines health and the humanities that's coming together at the university. You can join in with your insights, your questions, 800-642-1234. Louisa, how do you see this certificate program being a complement or companion to your majors that you already offer at the university?
Yeah, well, we're about to have a new major in public health that's just being launched this fall. So we're working very closely with the academics at the university who work in that program. So we think that this might be a certificate that public health majors could pick up along the way, right? It's 12 credits. So at least to start with, it's a reasonably straightforward program. We also have a large nursing program and a lot of nursing students. This fall, I'll be teaching world history, and I have, you know, a dozen or so nursing students in that class. I think this would be another way of nursing students thinking through their general education requirements and a way of sort of showing that students have experience in the humanities as they move into nursing programs and elsewhere. We also have a lot of pre-med students and pre-health professional students. And increasingly we're seeing that medical schools are looking for these kinds of experiences. A lot of medical schools require really intense writing experiences. So this is one way of documenting that experience too. And then, you know, a lot of our humanities programs, my own major in history, I work with a student who's going to go in to do a master's now in public health after a history major. And he just wrote a great thesis about the cholera outbreak in England in the 19th century. And he's really interested in this program. You know, it's coming a little late for him, but it's those kinds of students, I think, who can see or begin to see the way their interests sort of intersect that will be interested in taking the certificate too.
I was thinking this morning about the late poet William Carlos Williams, who was a full-time practicing physician in his lifetime, but also just this prolific poet. And I was just chuckling to myself, thinking how he would have appreciated health humanities programs.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's really growing across the country. I mean, there are about 100 health humanities programs, ranging from certificates to full-blown majors across the country now. So I think it speaks to this, the notion this is really timely and helps people think through medicine beyond just the science.
Do you consider this certificate program perhaps a stepping stone to a full degree program?
It's early days.
Okay.
That takes, you know, resources beyond an NEH grant, probably, but that would be great. I know that a lot of these departments are really committed to this idea. Eau Claire, the university, our slogan is the power of and, right? So we usually emphasize the fact that you can come to Eau Claire and major in the sciences and major in the humanities, or be a musician and somebody who's a practicing clinician at the same time. So I think it speaks to who the university is, the kinds of experiences we want students to have really with this experience, these high impact practices outside of the classroom. So I can imagine, yeah, that this is hopefully just the beginning of something a lot bigger.
What is the timeline here? When will students be able to enroll in the program?
So next fall, we're hoping we'll have the initial core course in the books, approved as it needs to be approved and ready for students to take. So they should be able to start enrolling then. We need to revise a few classes, think about other classes that need to be included in the certificate, and then identify these community partners. So this year is going to be a lot about building community within ourselves and making these connections in the wider Chippewa Valley community.
Can you give us some examples where we would see medical humanities in jobs, like finding jobs in the medical humanities?
I think that it's not as much a case of it being a separate kind of job, but mm-hmm. rather a preparation for a future career, usually as a clinician. But we're also seeing students with medical humanities or health humanities backgrounds go into government and other kinds of public service because I think it's a way of showing an awareness of the connections between acting in public, of trying to advance our communities, but also of having a background in the science of healthcare too.
So you're getting kind of this bigger, broader picture of what, you know, what you're studying.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, Louisa, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Louisa Rice is department chair and a professor of history at the UW-Eau Claire, creating a certificate program in integrative humanities. Coming up, a research analyst explains what happened to the Wauwatosa small engines manufacturer Briggs & Stratton after the company filed for bankruptcy last week. We'll explore that bankruptcy, what it means for manufacturing in Wisconsin. That is after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a closer look at recent bankruptcies in the manufacturing sector here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A major maker of gas engines for outdoor power equipment filed for bankruptcy last week. Briggs & Stratton Corporation was founded in Milwaukee in 1908, cited pressures from the COVID-19 pandemic in its news release on the bankruptcy. Analysts point to the decline in lawnmower sales over years as consumers move to battery and electric mowers, pushing down demand for small engine sales. So what's your reaction to Briggs & Stratton filing for bankruptcy? Are you surprised? Do you live in the Milwaukee area? What do you think the impact of this will be on the local economy? Do you use Briggs & Stratton mowers or other products? We're at 800-642-1234. Tom Hayes is a senior equity research analyst with North Coast Research covering the industrial sector. Tom, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So explain for us what Briggs & Stratton does. Give us a sketch of this company.
Yeah, you did a nice job. I mean, they've been a premier provider of small engines for lawnmowers, snowblowers, that type of equipment for over 100 years. And really, they've seen a lot of changes, as you mentioned, movement towards battery-powered, where they were probably slow to make those changes. But all in all, well-respected company in the space, and really just found themselves behind the eight ball over the last year or so.
And it's funny, you know, you could walk into someone's garage and point to some things like the snow blower in the corner or, you know, water pressure devices. You know, some of these small outdoor equipment have their engines in it, I understand.
I have one in my own garage myself.
Yeah, yeah. So what happened here? This company was founded in 1908. What happened to it here at the end?
Yeah, at the end, it was really kind of a culmination over probably 3 or 4 years where you saw, as you mentioned earlier, market changes. And one of the things that Briggs & LSO called out was a big change for them was the Sears bankruptcy. That took away a good part of their business. And the company did try to make some adjustments. About 2 years ago, they went through a number of plant closures, tried to kind of reposition the company, but still wasn't seeing a lot of growth. So about a year ago, they announced a strategic review of their business, hopefully to kind of refocus and provide some more growth. But, you know, that really didn't work out too well. So in March of this year, they announced their reorganization plan, trying to sell off their professional turf care equipment, which they had been building over the last 4 or 5 years. And then, as everyone knows, you know, COVID really hit in March at about the same time. And two key components of the reorganization plan included, one, again, the selling of those turf assets, and two, from a financial standpoint, the refinancing of about $200 million of debt that was due in December. And then with the challenges in the financial markets that really kind of hit after COVID, you know, kind of started rolling across the country, Briggs was unable to accomplish both those key initiatives. So we found ourselves at June 15th when their big interest payment was due. The board of directors decided not to make that payment, which effectively started the clock ticking on default. So they had 30 days notice. Then we jumped to July 15th. They did not make the payment, which was due. The debtors gave them over the weekend. And so essentially what they were doing was getting the forms ready for the prepackaged bankruptcy, which they filed that subsequent Monday.
Yeah, and so that brings in the private equity firm KPS Capital. They've made an offer. What do you see there?
You know, I think it's a good offer. I mean, I think one of the things that made the sale of the turf equipment business challenging is, you know, people saw that Briggs was struggling a little bit financially. So I don't think there were a lot of active bidders out there. But I think the private equity company you know, does have them well positioned. I haven't talked to them, but I think in some of their press releases, they did indicate some activities such as trying to grow the business, especially on the professional side, which is much more profitable than the residential side of the business for Briggs.
All right. Well, KPS Capital has made a $550 million stalking horse offer. In layman's terms, can you explain for us what a stalking horse offer is?
Yeah, quite simply, it's, you know, they took the first step in buying the assets. You know, obviously they received some you know benefit in that, and that, you know, it's kind of the bare minimum to buy the assets. The way that the process now for the bankruptcy is, there will be an auction to try to buy the assets if a higher bid comes in. If not, the private equity firm assumes the assets for that price.
Chris from Adams called, couldn't stay with us. Chris has a friend who just retired from Briggs & Stratton, and the friend told her that the higher-level management got big bonuses recently and wonders how this was allowed. And it's true that, you know, on July 1st, all the executive salaries were restored, and then the board also approved cash retention awards to the total of $5.1 million.
Yeah, it's often not fair, but it's also often a precursor to bankruptcy. So if you go back to that June 15th, when they missed or decided not to pay the interest payment, you know, the board made the decision to reallocate some of that interest payment for quote unquote retention bonuses to the management team. You could argue either way that, you know, it was the management team that got them into this mess, and we shouldn't keep them, or, you know, that's the board's decision. But you know, part of it was to keep them around for the continuation of the business, and B, to probably offset some of their equity awards that they've been received over the last, you know, number of years that essentially with the bankruptcy finally become worthless.
Yeah, and so these awards, it said, were in lieu of annual bonuses or long-term incentive compensation awards. What does this mean for stockholders?
Essentially with the filing, you know, any public equity becomes essentially worthless.
Mm. So what does the pandemic have to do with this bankruptcy?
Well, you know, it's kind of an interesting story, because I think, you know, normally it wouldn't have a huge effect, but where Briggs was in their transformation, they needed to complete a number of transactions in the financial markets. Again, I mentioned the refinancing of the debt that was due in December. They couldn't come to terms, I believe, you know, reading through the public filings, with their current debtors to get that refinanced. And that was one thing that had been kind of hanging over the company for a while. I mean, it wasn't a huge amount. It was only $200 million. But it was a transaction that Briggs couldn't get done at terms that they wanted to get it done at. And then the sale of the turf assets, so the company could focus on some of their newer businesses. Again, I think and this is my speculation, some companies could have been focusing on, said, you know, I'll just wait to bankruptcy and try to pick up those assets at a cheaper price.
We're talking with Tom Hayes, an equity research analyst with North Coast Research, looking at the bankruptcy of Briggs & Stratton, what it means for manufacturing in Wisconsin. With your insights, what is your reaction to this bankruptcy filing? Were you surprised? Do you live in the Milwaukee area? What do you think the impact of this will be on the local economy? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tom, what does this bankruptcy mean for the employees of Briggs & Stratton?
You know, at first blush, it should be pretty much business as usual. I know as part of the prepackaged filing, I believe Briggs worked out an agreement with the labor unions. I know there's been some recent news on changing of the health benefits and stuff like that. But I think as far as employment, Briggs has been pretty aggressive over the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years in you know, downsizing or shifting jobs. And I think for the most part, a lot of that work has been done. You can agree with it or not agree with it, but I think right now they have probably the right number of employees if they're going to keep the businesses they have in place.
You mentioned the demise of Sears as a contributing factor here. What is the relation to big box stores and these products?
Yeah, I mean, Sears was obviously a primary customer for Briggs in both the summer products, the lawn care, and then the winter and the snow products. You know, a lot of that business probably went to Home Depot and Lowe's. But I think a bigger challenge has been, and you mentioned it in your introduction, you know, the transition from gas-powered engines to electric engines for the homeowner on their lawn care products. It's been a gradual shift. If you go to a Home Depot this past lawn season, the battery products were more prominent than the gas products. And I think that's just been a shift that's also accelerated the challenges that Briggs has faced.
Looking at its peers in the industry, the Aaron's Company, which makes lawnmowers, has been doing well as sales of outdoor power equipment have increased during COVID. What do you see there?
I'm not as familiar with that, but I think it's just been a situation where it's kind of different markets.
Yeah, yeah. Let's bring in Matt now in Johnson Creek. Hi, Matt.
Hello. So you kind of just touched on my question. With people forget how many small engines are made in Wisconsin, Mercury, Aaron's, Generac, and I was wondering if your guest had any insight. Is there a potential waterfall effect, or how does this kind of cross over through all the small engines that are made throughout Wisconsin?
A good question. I think there should not be any direct impact to any of those companies. Just for disclosure, I do also cover Generac. But I think this was kind of for the most part, kind of a self-made problem at Briggs. You know, they got themselves highly leveraged, and they found themselves having to do some transactions that they weren't able to complete, thus necessitating the filing of the bankruptcy.
We're looking at how the pandemic is disrupting the manufacturing sector as Wauwatosa-based Briggs & Stratton filed for bankruptcy last week. Tom Hayes is a senior equity research analyst with North Coast Research. The pandemic has made some good for some businesses, devastating for others. What have you noticed as COVID has progressed and drastically changed the economy? What does this mean for manufacturing? What bankruptcies are you watching? Do you work for a small engine maker? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Tom Hayes here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're looking at the Chapter 11 bankruptcy of small engine manufacturer Briggs & Stratton and what it could mean for manufacturing as a whole. The more than century-old company that got its start in Milwaukee joins many other large companies that have filed for bankruptcy amid the pandemic. So they make small engines, residential, commercial, lawn and garden equipment, as we've been talking about, pressure washers, snow blowers, other power equipment. Do you use Briggs & Stratton mowers or other products? Did you work for this company or one of its suppliers? What do you think of the bankruptcy? Join in 800-642-1234. Tom Hayes is a senior equity research analyst with North Coast Research, and he stays with us. We heard from Tony in Whitewater, called in, couldn't stay with us, and Tony noticed that the quality of Briggs & Stratton hasn't kept up with its competitors. Tony had bought a Honda lawnmower back in the 80s, still runs great, Tony says, And it's an example, he thinks, of an American company letting quality slip. What could you say there?
You know, I think it's one challenge that Briggs obviously faced, especially on the mowers that you buy at the Home Depots. I think those are their most cost-sensitive products. So obviously, they need to be at a certain price point, which sometimes necessitates challenges as far as manufacturing. I will say that Briggs did a nice job of bringing manufacturing back for the commercial engines. They're made down in Alabama. They brought those back from Japan. I've actually visited the facility. And I know those are high quality.
Where are its other plants in the U.S. and the world?
Primarily, they just opened up a new facility in upstate New York, and I know they're doing some of their production facilities there. They do have several others. I believe they have some facilities in Asia as well.
So if you open up a brand new manufacturing plant, that takes lots and lots of dollars, lots of debt, I would assume. What happens to that brand new plant?
That's going to be kind of an interesting question, because I think some of the debt that Briggs had just previously brought onto their balance sheet was supported by those physical properties. So that also brings another wrinkle into the bankruptcy, in that there's not a lot of liquidation value. So that's why I think one of the things that the private equity firm found, at least, some kind of benefit that those facilities would stay with the company. So I think there is some positive there. The other thing we haven't talked about, they did just open up a new plant down south. I can't exactly remember where it was, for their new battery products. And I think that's a part of the business. It's small. It's probably, $30 million or so in revenue. But I think that's a very exciting part. And it's probably going to be a business that's growing. But I think it's probably something they got into too late to certainly on the residential side.
So battery products for, again, in this area of outdoor power equipment? Or is it batteries that could be used elsewhere?
Yeah, it's going to be used elsewhere. I think their biggest win that they've at least announced so far was with the golf cart manufacturer Club Car. When I met with Briggs several months ago to discuss the battery opportunity, some of that was going to be also used into the rental equipment market. So they hadn't really positioned a battery solution per se for the highly competitive residential market.
So they were mostly just say, okay, we're going to get these batteries going. We're going to get output here, and then we'll figure out the rest later?
They're a little brand agnostic, meaning that they're going to provide the battery solutions for a number of suppliers, hoping to kind of capture share that way.
Let's bring in Marcus now in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Good morning. So I grew up in Wauwatosa, literally about three blocks south of the Briggs & Stratton plant, just south of Burley, on 122nd. And back in the 90s when we moved over there, it was, there was cars parked three, four blocks south of the plant. I mean, and it's slowly, steadily been decreasing in employees and whatever. I don't think the COVID caused it. I think that this is just the final nail in the coffin from a whole lot of decades of bad decisions.
Interesting, Marcus, growing up near this plant and just watching the decrease in cars over the decades.
I agree. I think it's been a slow, painful decline. I mean, I think I could go back 4 or 5 years and like he indicated, call out different milestones or activities that probably were detrimental to the business. And like you said, it all culminated, in the unfortunate situation where Briggs couldn't get those final two transactions done, necessitating the bankruptcy filing.
So during bankruptcy, do their production lines at their plants stay going?
Yeah, that was part of the debtor in possession agreement with the private equity firm, that they provided working capital liquidity to keep the production going.
We're talking with Tom Hayes, Senior Equity Research Analyst with North Coast Research, looking at the Briggs & Stratton bankruptcy, what the future holds for this company and others like it in manufacturing. With your insights, your questions, 800-642-1234. So, Tom, Briggs is a big player in this sector of small gas engine manufacturing. What does this sector look like as a whole if you take Briggs out of the picture?
it's going to be kind of an interesting void if they leave on the residential side. I think the small gas engines, there are other players. I don't think there's a whole lot that are domestic. I think, like your previous caller mentioned, Honda, I think, is certainly a large player in there. And again, you're seeing more and more move to the battery side. On the professional side, Briggs has a very good product out there, their Vanguard product. Honda plays in that market as well. So does Kohler and another other couple of other companies. The battery power is not quite up to where it needs to be on the professional side. So I think that market will remain relatively whole. I think the residential market can survive absent of Briggs. I don't see that happening. I do imagine that the private equity firm, or if someone chooses to buy the assets, will continue to make those engines. You know, where they're made, how they're made is certainly going to be up to them. But I think, in all likelihood, you know, my guess sitting in my seat today is that the engines will, you know, continue to be made somewhere by someone.
So when you say the professional market, you mean for commercial lawn services, the equipment they use?
Yeah. So, you know, that was the other thing that Briggs had talked about there, the change in from you and I doing our own lawn service to hiring it out for someone to do it. And that's a market that was more attractive to Briggs, in that, you know, those engines are replaced more frequently, have a higher gross margin for Briggs. And that's been a kind of a shift over the last probably 4 or 5 years of more and more people, you know, choosing to have their lawn service done for them.
Well, Scott from La Crosse is wondering what will happen to warranties on Briggs & Stratton products.
As far as I know, and Briggs did do a nice job on their website of laying out several Q&As that kind of address that. I believe the warranties are going to be covered. I'll have to double check, but I think that was my first reading, that the warranties for some period of time will be covered.
As you look at bankruptcies in this area as a whole, is this bankruptcy, for lack of a better word, pretty straightforward?
You know, I think it became much more straightforward after they were not able to find any initial buyers for their turf care, professional turf care equipment. I think that was the extra 3 days from the Friday, the July 15th, to their filing date. It was pretty much what they would call a prepackaged bankruptcy, in that, you know, they had reached a tentative agreement with the labor union. They reached some other agreements as far as providing immediate liquidity to keep the plants open and running, to keep the suppliers still supplying product, to keep the insurance on and the lights on. So it was, you know, nothing like this is cut and dried, but this is kind of cookie cutter, if you will.
Does this bankruptcy reveal anything about the state of manufacturing in Wisconsin?
No, because I think one of your earlier callers mentioned Generac, and they're doing tremendously well. You know, they'll report earnings Thursday morning. You know, my expectations are they will continue to see strong, solid growth. So, again, this just happened to be a culmination of, you know, either, you know, missed opportunities by management, you know, tough macro environment. It was fairly specific.
Tom, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Tom Hayes is a senior equity research analyst with North Coast Research. Just ahead, we talk with a Democratic candidate running for Wisconsin's first congressional seat as part of our candidate conversations here on the Ideas Network leading up to the August partisan primary. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.